every bit as powerful.
The voices were amazing.
I loved it.
I thought it was simply amazing.
It's awesome.
Y'all need to come see this.
21 performances, April 16th through May 16th. Buy tickets today at crossandlight.com or 734-788-7073.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest today is Mike Eisenbath. Mike, for many years, 23 years in fact, was a sports writer. He spent 18 of those years with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and he wrote a very interesting article recently for the Christian Review on Mark McGwire, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But Mike's been married 30 years to his wife, Donna. They have four grown children, two grandsons. They live in the St. Louis area. And Mike left sports writing in 2002 because of depression, and we're going to talk about that in the second half of our hour. But I want our listeners to know that he wrote the Cardinals Encyclopedia, so if you're a Cardinals fan, you're in luck. And then another book entitled Hence My Eyes Are Turned Toward You, Confronting Depression with Faith and the Prayer of Jehoshaphat. And I'm so glad I could pronounce that. Mike Eisenbath, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you for having me, Dale. I appreciate it.
Well, you're a very interesting guy, and I'm really glad that you're on Church and Culture. You've published now three columns at the Christian Review, all very good. The last of particular interest to sports fans, because it was about your relationship with Mark McGwire, who you were covering for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, in the year of his breaking the Major League Baseball home run record. And am I right in saying that did you attend most of the games that year?
1998, traded to the Cardinals from Oakland during the year of 97, and we got a pretty good indication from that because he ended up with well more than 50 home runs that year between the two teams. And so we had a pretty good idea that he at least could make a challenge of the record in St. Louis. And so from the very beginning of even before the season started, my sports editor and I talked about that and said, you know, let's go ahead and go all in on this thing. So I basically was the Mark McGwire writer that entire summer. And I traveled to most of the away games. And I think of his 70 home runs, I saw 59 of them.
That's so very, very interesting.
For most of it.
Were you a fan personally? Was he a hero? What did you think of him during that summer and when he finally broke the record?
Well, you know, one of the things I learned pretty quickly is not to be a fan of anyone in particular because, you know, when you're trying to write in a non-biased way, you have to be honest with people about people that you're writing about. So I wouldn't necessarily say I was a fan. I was a huge baseball fan. And at that time, baseball was having its troubles. You know, right now we see it's a booming sport, but things weren't that way in 97 and 98. The player strike had been only a few years earlier, and that had canceled the World Series, and a lot of people just flat out left and didn't want to come back. And McGwire and Sammy Sosa from the Cubs in Chicago, who kind of they battled each other all year long for the record, their rivalry, it was a friendly rivalry, but it was still one. That kind of brought people back in a lot of ways and really brought a lot of excitement back to the game. So as a fan of baseball, I enjoyed watching that happen.
I noticed in your article that you make the comment that that home run derby, that race, may have saved baseball from falling further into the doldrums.
I remember sitting when the Cardinals were playing in Milwaukee against the Brewers, and Bud Selig was the commissioner of baseball at the time, and he was from Milwaukee. I remember sitting in his office, and he was just going over the attendance at various places around baseball that year and about how incredibly increased those attendance figures were. And he basically said it exactly as you did, that they saved baseball because there needed to be something to inject life back into the sport for people who had pretty much sworn off of it.
And then, of course, the bubble burst. How long after that season and that record did the issue of steroid use among Major League Baseball players arise?
It was a few years after that, after Mark had retired, actually. He retired after the 2001 season because he just had so many injuries, he just couldn't keep going. And it was probably 3 years after that, around 2004 or 5, that really the first information started coming out about steroid use. And Jose Canseco, who is a former teammate of Mark's in Oakland, wrote a book that he disclosed about his use of steroids and named several players, and Mark was one of those.
Did he name Barry Bonds, too?
He did not name Barry Bonds in that book, but he did talk subsequently and brought Barry's name up. Not that he had specific knowledge of it, but that he had strong suspicion from watching, just the way his body had developed and changed. So we know what happened with the story after that, where, there was a 2003 report that was leaked a couple years after that, internal report from Major League Baseball about players that had tested positive, and that, Sammy Sosa was caught in that group. There were quite a few that we still don't know their names.
McGuire wasn't caught because he had retired.
Exactly. He never tested positive for steroids. It was all, accusations as far as his name was concerned, but they were by people that had witnessed it. So at a certain point, when he went before Congress to testify along with some of the other players, he famously said, "I don't want to talk about the past. I want to move on from here." Eventually he had to talk about it, and he did finally admit it, which is something that Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and, several other big players still have not done.
No, Clemens went to the wall to avoid admission of guilt on that. So how much later, after the congressional testimony, did Mark McGuire finally fess up?
It was 2 or 3 years later. He became the hitting coach for the Cardinals at a certain point, and I think he pretty much knew that this issue was not going to go away and he would be a distraction to the team if he didn't talk about it. So before the season started, after he was named the batting coach, he gave an interview. I can't remember who that interview was with, where he basically said, it's probably ESPN, where he admitted that, yes, he had used it, he regretted it, and pretty much wanted to move on from that point.
It's my memory that at the time there was a lot of public sympathy for his finally coming out and admitting it. Is that correct?
Well, I think it was mixed, to be honest with you, because I think that I wouldn't use the word sympathy, but I think there was an appreciation that he at least admitted it. And here in St. Louis, the Cardinals are a, a civic treasure here. It's a part of the DNA of people.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Green Bay Packers.
Exactly, exactly. You know, and for such a small market, they still draw more than 3 million people every year. And, you know, it's a phenomenon here that's unusual. And so the Cardinals fans are pretty forgiving for a lot of things. And, you know, they pretty much said, okay, you're our guy. You made a mistake. You made some bad decisions, but we're not gonna ridicule you for that. And, you know, he was received warmly here. Not so throughout the rest of the country, though. And his name is still, in a lot of parts of the country, kind of mud. he contributed to the tainting of a game that he had helped lift up. Fortunately, there are other forces right now that are keeping baseball going, including that they've really cleaned up the steroid usage, and there's regular drug testing, and you can try to get away with something now, and people will always try to cheat, I think, but it's going to be difficult to get by with steroids at this point.
Now, one thing that I always wanted to ask somebody who had a firsthand experience of that year, that race, and subsequently the Barry Bonds explosion, home run explosion. Wasn't it pretty obvious to people that their bodies were developing in extraordinary ways, and sort of non-natural ways, even for guys who worked out all the time?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that during that season in 98, I did a story because he was a mammoth man and, you know, extremely muscular. And if you looked at him early in his career, he was very thin, still strong, and still hit a lot of home runs, but nothing, his appearance was nothing like it turned into in 97 and 98. So I did a story on his weight training regimen, and he was incredible. He was in the weight room all the time. You know, even after games, he would go in there and lift. And I've got to admit, I was naive in that steroids never crossed my mind. I'd never been around any of it. I didn't know, medically, what to look for in a person other than the fact that they'd gotten large. But, with all the weightlifting he did, we all pretty much thought that explained away because he was devoted there.
Well, the weightlifting, the steroid use simply multiplied the impact of weightlifting. Is that correct?
And the thing, the thing that we've all learned over the last few years is that, steroid usage on its own does not necessarily build great muscle, but it does allow your body to recover more quickly and therefore spend more time in the gym, not just spending 2 hours instead of 1 hour, but shortly after playing a sport, you can go into the weight room shortly after that and continue to build that muscle.
Yeah, normally you have to give your muscles a rest and let them rebuild before they can be stressed again.
Absolutely. And, looking back now, one thing that I've learned that I honestly didn't know at the time was that acne can appear when you're using steroids. And he did have a good bit of acne on his upper back. So, had I been familiar with steroid usage, maybe I would have suspected something in looking at that. Now, a couple of the things that with Barry Bonds were a little more telling, his hat size grew. And apparently that's, a side effect of
it wasn't just his ego?
No, that was always large.
I must say, Mike, I'm talking with Mike Eisenbath, who was a sports writer for 23 years, a sports writer in St. Louis for the Post-Dispatch for 18. Barry Bonds always put me off, whereas Sosa and McGuire I found fun and amiable to watch. But there was something about Bonds that just I didn't care for the man.
Well, you weren't the only one. I spent a lot of time around him as well, and Sammy. And, Sammy was just very outgoing and gregarious and you know, just happy to be alive a lot of times. Mark was a little more reserved. Gave people the impression that he, you know, he didn't care or didn't like people. I got along great with him. I still think he's a good person who made some bad decisions. Barry, on the other hand, even before he was assaulting a home run record, and I did cover him throughout 2001 when he broke McGuire's record, he was always kind of off on his own. I remember one time talking with his manager, Dusty Baker, and Dusty told me that there were two cliques in his clubhouse. There were 24 players in one clique and then Barry Bonds in the other. So he had a lot of teammates that he didn't get along with or, you know, wasn't friendly with either. So it wasn't just reporters. It wasn't just teammates. It was fans as well.
Well, let me make this comment. I'm an old-time Yankee fan. I grew up keeping Mickey Mantle's record book on the wall of my room as a boy. I followed his batting average, his home runs, his slugging percentage day by day. And of course, in 1961, I was 12 years old and got to see some of those games where Mantle and Maris were hitting two home runs a game apiece. I saw one of them in the old Griffin Stadium. And so I had a personal sort of connection to the home run record, especially, you know, given that, you know, I'd spent most of my adolescence and young adulthood following the Yankees. And I'm still a bit peeved that the home run records, official records, have never been adjusted in spite of this disclosure about steroids. Why haven't they been addressed because of the steroid use?
Baseball is an interesting game in that it's been played for so long, and it's never adjusted records. You know, when Mantle and Maris were playing in 61, the schedule had 154 games. You know, now they play 162. You know, those eight extra games, you know, can make a huge difference in records as far as, you know, how many hits you get, how many home runs, how many strikeouts a pitcher gets, you know, a variety of things. But baseball has never adjusted. They don't have a record book just for a 154-game schedule or a 162-game schedule. They don't have a record book for when there were only eight teams in each league instead of 30 teams overall now. You know, so baseball pretty much doesn't like to monkey around with its record books. And, you know, Deal, from growing up, there were a lot of people that in 61 that thought, you know, Maris should have had an asterisk, you know, after his name for whatever reason, in breaking Babe Ruth's record.
Because he played 162 games compared to the 154 of Babe Ruth.
Right. So, you know, baseball just hasn't done that. And I'm wondering if at a certain point baseball's going to need to address that, because I think there's a lot of fans who feel like they should. The difficult part is, who do you say their record gets an asterisk and someone else doesn't? Because even if you never were accused of steroid usage, that entire period in baseball history is somewhat tainted now. You know, Jeff Bagwell, who played for the Houston Astros and probably deserves to be in baseball's Hall of Fame, keeps falling short of the votes because they're are suspicions that he was using asteroids.
Do you think that McGuire, Sosa, and Bonds will get into the Hall of Fame?
I don't think McGuire and Sosa ever will. I think Bonds has a shot because, you know, let's face it, he was an incredible player before he got to the point where he decided he wanted to set the home run record. You know, he was unbelievable. You know, in his early years,
he was kind of a Tiger Woods of baseball.
He was. You know, he was. You know, there was a lot of debate at that time on, you know, if you were talking about the greatest players in the history of baseball. You know, Willie Mays often comes up in that conversation, who, interestingly enough, is Barry's godfather. And Barry's name would be right there with that in the argument. So, you know, I think there's a chance that a lot of people will consider after a time putting him in. If he doesn't get voted in, a veterans committee can select him and go put him in. So I think there's a good chance that someday he'll do that.
But Pete Rose never got in, did he?
No, Pete Rose is officially banned from baseball, though, and because he broke a rule that there's no wiggle room on this. You walk into every single clubhouse in baseball and post it on the front door of that clubhouse is that you cannot bet on baseball. I mean, you're just not allowed to do it. So he knowingly broke a record that he walked past every single day. Steroids weren't illegal at that time, and they weren't a banned substance from baseball at that time. They were just wrong, you know. And
yeah, they were. I mean, if you're an athlete, you think about things about fairness. I remember famous. I was also a Dallas Cowboy fan back in the Tom Landry days, and I don't know which game it was. I don't know who the Cowboys were playing, but it was an important game. And a tackle, defensive tackle on the other team had badly hurt his shoulder. And the Cowboy, on the first play from scrimmage, said, "Which shoulder is it?" And the guy told him. And the Dallas Cowboy linesman never went after that shoulder during the entire game.
Mm.
Now, would that ever happen these days?
No, I mean, you know, there's a famous, in the NFL now, there's a famous scandal, basically, where in New Orleans, one of the Saints assistant coaches was paying some of his players extra money if they got a certain hit on a certain player. If they took
right.
a player out of the game, they got got a bunch of money. If they went after
right.
the knees of the quarterback, they got money for that. So, yeah, you know, that's obviously the game, and sports in general have changed, I think. The thing that's interesting about baseball, though, there have always been people, not widespread, but always people trying to cheat the game a little bit. You know, at one time...
Well, Ty Cobb, you know, what is he, sharpening his cleats?
Sharpened his cleats, and, you know, a lot of players, you know, Gaylord Perry is famous for using Vaseline on a baseball.
Right.
You know, spitballs, and there have been players who put cork inside their bats because the ball jumps off of it quicker. They're in the 70s, amphetamines were widely used, and, you know, that was to increase the motivation and the energy for players in games. So, you know, it's kind of hard. If we taint this era and put asterisks on it, then do we have to go back to the 70s?
Well, and Ritalin and the other amphetamine are commonly given to probably millions of Americans.
Right, and right now baseball is trying to address that a little bit too, where they've put that on a banned substance list unless, you know, you can show with a doctor's, you know, signing off on it that you've got ADHD, and so you're allowed to take those medications. But, you know, we see in society now that it's not too difficult for you to get diagnosed with ADHD if you really want to be.
Talking with Mike Eisenbath, who is a former sports writer, he now writes about his faith, about his personal struggle with depression that we're going to talk about in the second half of the hour, and about being a Catholic man in general, which I agree is an issue that needs to be addressed. We're talking about late women's issues so much, it seems like men get sort of left out of the conversation. And he has his own website. It's www.eisenbath.com, and that's how it sounds, E-I-S-E-N, Bath, eisenbath.com. And it's got wonderful resources there. Not just for those of us who fight depression, and I've struggled with that my entire life since I was a teenager, but for those men and women and families and husbands and wives out there who just trying to pick their way through a rather dangerous world that we live in and culture that doesn't support the kind of lives we're trying to lead. Mike, one more question about baseball and sports in general, which really is a reflection of my own frustration with it, is that, you know, I grew up a very avid football fan. I'm a graduate of the University of Texas. We won two national championships while I was there. The Dallas Cowboys, the New York Yankees. But somewhere along the way, I lost interest in both baseball and professional football, and to some degree college football, because of the kinds of things we're talking about. You know, not just the sort of the loss of the old style of, you know, fighting fairly and playing, you know, the respect for the rules, and but the fundamental issue of, you know, hot dogging and, you know, spiking the ball, all these things that I just found deeply distasteful. And, it's, you know, in basketball, forget it. Although I think that's kind of calmed down. And hockey, at the time, I tried to get interested in hockey, and they were just taking every opportunity to fight on the ice that they possibly could. And that's why, I mean, the only sport I watch anymore is golf. At least there's still it's still a sport where manners are displayed.
It's unfortunate, and I think you echo the sentiment of a lot of people. For myself, you know, I was in a position where I could have really turned against sports in general because, you know, I did see the negative side of a lot of things that fans don't even get to see. You know, during the games, you find the people that are, you know, distasteful people in general, and the behavior that these guys sometimes have on the road is not something that you would want to ever wish on your children, obviously, and anyone you care about as far as you know, the adultery and, you know, just a variety of other things. I think a couple things helped me. One was, in the course of seeing the negative side of people and athletes over the years, I also got to see that there are some really, really good people that are involved. You know, case in point right now is with the Cardinals manager, Mike Matheny. He played for the Cardinals while I was covering them. A devout family man, a great Christian man, really goes about things in a hard-working, good way. And, you know, now that I'm separated from covering things, I root for Mike Matheny because he's a good guy, and I want to see people like that succeed in these sports.
Yeah.
And maybe that will help, you know, bring some things back. But I think part of it is just a reflection of society, too. You know, if you look at parents of kids playing sports now, you know, select teams that play year-round and travel all over the place, and you specialize in one sport because at the age of 10, your parents have decided that you're going to play college baseball and get a scholarship, you know, instead of just having it as fun. And I got a six-year-old grandson now who's playing baseball, and I just want him to have fun. You know, we go out in the backyard, play wiffle ball. He pretends he's a Cardinals player at bat. That's what you and I did as kids.
That's what we did, and I still... Every spring when they start mowing the grass, I can see myself out there practicing and bunting and running bases and throwing. I was a third baseman, making that tough throw to third. But we're going to have to take a break now and get off the reminiscing. So all of you who are listening, we'll hope you'll hang around. We'll be back with Mike Eisenbeth right after this message.
Ave Maria School of Law in Naples, Florida is offering full tuition scholarships for dedicated Catholics. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The scholarship offers a 3-year full tuition scholarship and a generous first-year stipend based on LSAT scores. Qualified candidates should live or study in Michigan or the Toledo area. Learn more about this tremendous opportunity by visiting AveMariaFoundation.org. That's AveMariaFoundation.org or call 734-930-3587.
It's everywhere you look.
You cannot walk down the street without being bombarded.
They call it a clutter crisis.
Consumers are like roaches. You spray them, and after a while it doesn't work anymore. We develop immunities.
And the multi-billion-dollar advertising industry is in a desperate struggle to break through.
We don't just come forward with what we want to sell. We engage you with things that you want.
Advertisers have blurred the line between programming and product.
Advertisers, along with the entertainment and news industries, have blurred the line between image and reality. On Saturday, May 9th, at the Ford Motor Company Conference and Event Center in Dearborn, Dereza Tamio and Al Cresta will lift the curtain on the illusion industries and how they create spiritual competitors to the Catholic faith. That's Saturday, May 9th, at the Ford Conference and Event Center in Dearborn. Learn more at AveMariaRadio.net.
Hi, Deacon Tom here with a reminder that Ave Maria Radio has some terrific gift ideas for you. Books by our hosts and our guests, recordings on CD, and our new Wi-Fi radios, so you can listen to Catholic radio anywhere in the world, anytime you want, as long as you have a Wi-Fi connection. Just go to our website and click the word store on the right side of the page, just below the EWTN logo. It's an easy way to shop, and you can help Catholic radio at the same time. The website can be found at AveMariaRadio.net.
With my guest, Mike Eisenbath, who has been telling us fascinating insider stories about the home run race of 1998 between Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa. Mike was covering that race and covering Mark McGwire for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and about the issue of steroids that arose a few years later and the general issue of drugs, baseball, morality in sports in general, and the impact that's had on a lot of its fans, like me. Mike, you walked away from your job at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, where you'd been 18 years, because of clinical depression. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I was at my dream job from the day, from 10 years old, I told everyone that one day I would cover the Cardinals for the Post-Dispatch. And I got there and I was doing it. And in the winter of 2001, 2002, completely catching me off guard, I couldn't get out of bed. And if I did get out of bed, I couldn't get off of my recliner or the couch. I didn't have to go to work every day because I had a lot of comp time built up. But, you know, it got to a point where I couldn't pick my kids up from school. I'd call my mom and say, Mom, can you go pick them up? And I eventually got diagnosed with depression, and I had to make a really tough decision. I justified it to the world that my oldest had just gotten to high school. I had four kids, and I knew my time with them was getting short. So I thought, you know, this isn't worth it. I want to see them play sports. I want to be here when they get home from school and talk to them about all that. So I told people I left for that reason. But the real reason I left was because I didn't know how I'd get to work if I couldn't leave my house.
Now, did this come on slowly or did it happen suddenly?
No, it seemed to kind of gradually begin sometime maybe around November of 2001. It increased in its severity, and by the time I got to January, I knew something was wrong, so I went to my doctor. And he diagnosed it and prescribed me some antidepressants, but it kept getting worse.
So, in spite of the drugs, it got worse.
Yeah, in spite of the medication, and it got to a point where I would just start sobbing for absolutely no reason at all, and the sobbing would persist. You know, whether it was in the shower or in my car or at my desk with the new job that I took, the crying was incredible, the sadness that just overwhelmed me. I never smiled or laughed anymore. I didn't want to go do things with friends and family. So everything had changed. And eventually, I went from seeing my doctor for this, my primary care doctor, to I did start visiting a psychiatrist. And psychiatrists are a little more equipped to deal with it medically, medication, because they know what a real therapeutic dosage is for these antidepressants. And if one's not working, they can come up with a second idea. Part of the issue for me, and it's not unusual, only 30% of the people that get diagnosed with depression respond well to medication.
Only 30%.
Only 30%, basically, their depression disappears because of the medication.
And this is we're talking about drugs like Wellbutrin and Zoloft and Prozac
exactly.
And Xanax and all the different array of drugs that are given for people with depression.
Exactly. And, you know, for the other 70% of us, you know, the first one doesn't work, so you try a second one, and then you try a third one. And, you know, I mean, there's three families of antidepressants. So you go through, you know, the first family, and if nothing works, then you try a different family.
Very quickly, and Mike, what are those families?
There's the tricyclics are the earliest antidepressants. Those are the ones that, for instance, my mom would have taken in the 70s. When she had severe depression.
Is that like Xanax and Prozac?
No, Prozac came with the second family, which are the MAO inhibitors.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you the science of all these. I just know their names. And then there's the SSRIs that are the fairly new ones. That's where you would find a lot of the
like
Wellbutrin and Zoloft is an SSRI. So, you know, usually what doctors tend to do now is they go with the newest stuff because it has had a little better track record as far as success.
But 30% is not very good success.
No, it's not. And then the group that I think I probably fit into is that middle percentage where the medication helps me manage life.
Right.
It doesn't mean that I'm cured. I still deal with it every day.
It doesn't mean that you jump out of bed singing show tunes.
Absolutely not. And even if I jump out of bed, which lately I've been in a place where I can get out of bed a lot quicker than I have for years, but, you know, it's still exhausting to get through the day. I'm taking it an hour at a time. And therapy, talk therapy, does help an awful lot, too.
So you're still struggling with this.
I am. I've probably been through just about every medication I think that's available. I finally, when my doctor got back to the tricyclics, which, again, would have been the things that were used in the 60s and 70s, I found a little success with those. Part of my problem, and this is a common problem, is that, you know, some of these medications, you never find out if they work or not because the side effects show up. For me, with all the SSRIs, the fairly new ones, I would get tremors in my hands that I couldn't hold a pen to write.
That's what happened to my putting, I guess, when I started writing that stuff. Talking with Mike Eisenbath, who I would say that he and his wife Donna have an apostolate to people who struggle with depression, a Catholic apostolate, and I'm particularly pleased to have him on this show because I think this is a very widely shared problem and one that people feel some shame about admitting. I mean, I'm not the least bit ashamed to say I've struggled with it my whole life. I still do. I've gone through the gamut of medication. Some work, some don't. Some work for a while, and they don't work later. And what have you discovered, Mike, beyond sort of addressing the body chemistry, the brain chemistry, which is what meds do, what works to allow you not just to function, but to feel a little lift from day to day?
You know, it's a great question, and it's one that and you talked about kind of the Catholic perspective and the apostolate that my wife and I have, it's a message that we are not ashamed to talk about and to share. Part of the message is, it begins that we're extremely honest. I've had 3 suicide attempts, and the 3rd one came really close to succeeding. So we'll tell people that, and she'll tell people that, hey, you know, I don't always like being around Mike when he's this way, but, you know, we've still been married for 30 years. So, a lot of it's the honesty that then leads to me being honest with people and saying, the number one reason that I'm still here is because God loves me and does not want me to come home yet. There's a purpose.
Not till it's his time.
Not until it's his time. There's something that I can still do here, especially for helping people in this situation or just with their spirituality. And
now, how old are you? I would guess we're close to the same age, Mike.
I'm 53.
That was wrong about that. I'm 8 years older than you are.
But, you know, the book that I wrote, the message of that book is that, and from the prayer of Jehoshaphat, which I won't go into the full story.
Well, by the way, before you, let me give everyone the name of the whole book and then tell us how the prayer of Jehoshaphat fits in. The book is entitled, Hence My Eyes Are Turned Toward You, Confronting Depression with Faith and the Prayer of Jehoshaphat. And it can be found, I'm sure, on Amazon, but also on Mike's website, eisenbath.com. So what about the prayer of Jehoshaphat, Mike?
Here's the quick synopsis of the story. Jehoshaphat was a king of Israel, and He didn't always behave himself. He did some things that weren't kosher with God. And at a certain point, there were 3 different tribes that were going to attack Israel. And he found this out, and he basically went into a panic. So he called all the people together, and he was going to stand up in front of them and address them. And everyone probably thought, well, here's what we're going to do to fight this battle. And he then said a prayer in front of them, instead of giving them, you know, battle plans. And the crux of the prayer were these words: Lord, can you see this enemy coming at me? I am powerless against them, and I don't know what to do. Hence, my eyes are turned toward you. I took that part of the prayer, and instead of the enemy, I inserted depression. But, I tell people all the time, whatever adversity you face, that's your enemy. So you can pray this prayer with Jehoshaphat. And I would say, you know, God, see what this depression is doing. I don't know what to do about it, and I'm powerless against it, so I'm only going to look to you. And you.
So this is from 2 Chronicles chapter 20.
Exactly, exactly.
So repeat that prayer again for our listeners.
Lord, see this enemy coming at me. I'm powerless against it, and I don't know what to do. Hence, my eyes are turned toward you. You know, now, when I faced my adversity, my depression, I never said, why me, God? And I know there are a lot of people that get, you know, a chronic illness, possibly an illness where they face death or an incredible change in their life or any adversity, and they're like, God, why? Why are you doing this? I never asked why. All I said was, God, I don't know why, and I don't know what can come out of this, but I'm going to keep my eyes on you. And
well, I'm sorry to interrupt, Mike, but what shocks me here is that if what you had described happened to you happened to me, then I would say, okay, this has been coming on for 50 years, okay? But yet, you didn't have a history with it. It just kind of descended on you.
Exactly.
Do you have any explanation for that?
Well, some of it could be hereditary. There is a lot of gene passing on of depression. My mom had it pretty severely in the early 70s. She was hospitalized for 3 months consecutively at one point. and received shock treatment, what we call electroconvulsive.
Oh, yeah, I remember those.
She was basically comatose for quite some time because they gave her so much of it. I received that, too, for about a three-week period.
When did you receive that?
That was in 2006.
So you actually had shock treatment yourself.
I did, yep.
Did that help?
It actually helped my anxiety somewhat, not completely, and it made me feel, I would say, a little better for a while.
Well, you haven't asked for a lobotomy yet, have you?
No. Well, there are people, especially those close to me, that insist I already had it.
I find, the reason I'm joking with you is you know I'm joking with you, because
absolutely,
you have to joke. You have to get the black humor of the situation. It's just very helpful to me, and I know to you as well.
It is. And again, I think part of it that, we got to a certain point, it was shortly after my ECT in 2006, we tried to keep this a secret. Our close family knew about it. Obviously, my children knew about it. They were in high school around
wow.
age at the time. And some of my very closest friends knew about it. But the world in general did not. And, excuse me, we found at a certain point that it was really especially wearing on my kids because, they had this secret that they weren't telling anyone.
Right.
And, things would come up, there's a whole litany of stories I could tell you where they had to keep their mouth shut or bite their tongue or whatever.
Now, why does your dad not get out of bed in the morning?
Yeah. Hey, your dad's always home. What's going on?
Or why does your dad never smile?
And that was a huge one that they recognized too. And even they ask that question of me sometimes.
And so what they're wondering is, why is my father suddenly changed so drastically?
And one of the things that I think helped them in their lives now is that they understand that we didn't give up. Our marriage became stronger because of it.
Your wife Donna must be quite a lady.
She's unbelievable. She's the saint in my life.
I mean,
and
she took the full brunt of it.
She did, and she was actually working at the time at the National Shrine of Our Lady of the Snows in Belleville, Illinois, and that was a 45-minute drive away from home for us. So there would be days where I would call her and I was sobbing and I didn't know how I could make it through the rest of the day. And she'd have to drive 45 minutes home.
Wow.
Wondering what she was going to find when she got home.
And there was this issue of suicide hanging over her as well, your suicide.
Yeah, not only had I had the three suicide attempts, I had put myself into the hospital several times because I didn't feel safe with myself.
I remember, Mike, the first time I ever went to a psychiatrist for depression, as I was leaving the first session, he said, "Now, I want you to know I've reserved a padded cell for you. So if it ever gets something, if ever you can't handle it, we'll put you in that cell."
Yep.
And, it made me laugh. And it also made me feel secure.
Yeah, but, the unfortunate part is, doctors don't tell their patients that anymore because there's a lot of areas in this country that don't have very many psychiatric beds available. It's not a money-making thing for hospitals or insurance companies, so it's hard to find a bed.
It's interesting.
Room.
Now that we're talking about this, I'm thinking of all the things that I've used over the years to try to treat myself. Things like taking baths, hot baths. I know that St. Thomas Aquinas, my saint, suffered from melancholy, too, and he took long hot baths, listening to music, obviously playing golf, hitting golf balls, walking the dogs, throwing on some really bad-smelling cologne. There's just lots of little tricks I've used over the years just to get me out of funk. Now, is this something you find common among people who suffer from depression?
Yeah, and one of the things, after we came forward and started talking about this, and I wrote my book and we talked about it more and I've done radio shows and and written about it quite frequently in the St. Louis Review. What I found was that people were so glad that someone was talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
Because they found a kindred spirit that they could talk to about it. So I get calls every day from strangers.
Every day. I bet you do.
Every single day I get emails. And, you know, sometimes, or when Donna and I give a talk, usually what happens after the talk is we split up. I go on one side, she goes in the other, and we have a long line of people that want to talk to each of us. They ask me, what can I expect from my depression? I just got diagnosed. Or they ask her, you know, my husband's had this for years, and I don't know what to do. What can I do? So they found that kindred spirit in us. But one of the other things that we've also found is there is a great deal of research on things that can help. It doesn't cure, but it can help. Exercise is extremely
right.
important. If you can get out and just take a walk, as you've discovered on the golf course, that can improve your mood.
I'm never sad on the golf course.
Well, I am, because but you haven't seen me swing. So, but, you know, a good diet. You know, there are certain things you want to keep out of your
right.
diet.
Is this all in your book, by the way?
A lot of it is, and there's a lot of it on my website, too.
Yeah, I'm looking at your website, and I want to tell our listeners again that if you go to eisenbath.com, you have a contact us page where you can send in by email. You can send Mike and Donna your phone number. You can make a large a long comment if you like. There's also a Facebook page which is entitled Offering Hope for the Journey, where you can I assume someone could message you through that Facebook page.
Absolutely. And I made a pledge to God a long time ago that I will respond to everybody to the best of my ability. Sometimes the best of my ability is to say, you really need to call your doctor right now, you know, because that'll happen. Or, hey, you know, I'm going to check with you later on to see how you're doing. You know, I try to make sure the best I can to point people in the right direction or to listen.
And you talk to people about the Jehoshaphat prayer, which the essence of which is there's this thing bearing down on me that is destructive, which I'm powerless to throw off, and I don't really understand it, and I'm looking to you, oh Lord, to help me.
And the beautiful part of that story is that after he said that, there was a prophet in the crowd named Jehaziel who heard God tell him to speak up. So he spoke up and he told Jehoshaphat and the people, he said, God wants me to tell you that this battle is not yours, it's his battle. So
wow.
He's just going to stand and watch what God does. So they did. The Israelites didn't get their armor, they didn't get their swords. They went, stood on a hill, sang and danced to God and watched as those three tribes defeated each other. And then they were able to go down and pick the spoils from the fallen.
I just have to interject that I've been reading a lot of Jungian psychology on the subject of depression. And one common theme they have is to detach the judgment of your mind from the thoughts you have that make you sad.
And
that's the analogy of, you know, letting God fight it. You know,
exactly.
When you judge yourself, you're taking on the fight.
Well, and you know, the sadness and negativity that comes with depression is so overwhelming that, you know, what I would go through some days is I'd tell myself, you are a terrible father. You are a terrible husband. You're an awful son. You're a horrible friend. And I got to a point where I was literally believing that every day, and that drives you to the depths of despair. But what I learned to do is write down, you're a horrible father, and then list all the reasons that disputed that. And at a certain point, you can rewire your brain a little bit to say, when you hear that in your head, you say, no, it's not true. I already proved that that's
right.
True.
They call it journaling. Mike, I am just delighted that you've been so open with us here on Church and Culture today, both when it comes to your experience with Mark McGwire and baseball, but also with your own personal tribulation that descended on you in 2002, which you're still struggling with. I hope two things, that you'll keep writing for the Christian Review on about this and other subjects. Secondly, that you'll come back on Church and Culture again sometime soon.
Whenever you have you'd have me, I'd be happy to help.
Thank you, Mike, and give our greetings to your obviously very wonderful wife, Donna.
I absolutely will, Bill. Thank you.
And all of you who have been listening, we're going to take a short break and come back then with another extremely interesting guest.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. Right to Life Lifespan invites you to their annual Celebration of Life dinner and auction, Tuesday, May 5th at the San Marino Club in Troy. Several surprise guests will be featured as Right to Life Lifespan celebrates 45 years of respecting and protecting the dignity of all human life. Tickets are $60 and can be reserved by calling 248-816-1546. With Mother's Day right around the corner, take the opportunity to deepen your relationship with our spiritual mother at Mary Our Mother, Things My Mother Taught Me. Monsignor Ronald Brown will be giving this talk at St. Hugo of the Hills in Bloomfield Hills, Friday, May 8th. For further details, call 248-439-1652. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077.
Saturday, April 25th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., G.A. Fuchs presents Meet the Author. Judy Cragen will be signing her new book, Amazing Graces, The Blessings of Sacramentals. This book has been endorsed by many Catholic authors, and you'll enjoy it. That's this Saturday, April 25th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at G.A. Fuchs on Stevenson Highway, just south of 14 Mile in Madison Heights. While you're there, be sure to check out Julie's other books, which will also be on display.
Men, it's time to rise up, to accept the challenge, to become that for which you were made. Join hundreds of other men when you participate in the Diocese of Lansing's 7th Annual Men's Conference, Saturday, April 25th from 8:30 to 3 at St. Mary Magdalene Church in Brighton. This year, hear inspirational messages from Bert Gezzi and Matthew Leonard, music by Brian Flynn, and Mass with Bishop Earl Boyer. Learn more and register at acceptthechallenge.org. That's acceptthechallenge.org.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
In Sunday's first reading, Peter, after doing a miracle that got people's attention, said to the Supreme Court of Israel, "If we're being examined today about a good deed done to a cripple, then all of you should know that it was done in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom you crucified, but whom God raised from the dead. That this man stands before you, healed. There's no salvation through anyone else, nor is there any other name given to the human race by which we are to be saved." And the Gospel takes up the theme of the Good Shepherd. Jesus said, "I am the Good Shepherd." A good shepherd laid down his life for his sheep. A hired man who is not a shepherd, and whose sheep are not his own, sees a wolf coming and leaves the sheep and runs.